Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The head of the Syrian delegation to proximity talks in Geneva, Bashar Jaffari, criticized the opposition for calling a pause in the negotiations on the country's political transition. Speaking Wednesday, he said if they leave, the talks will not lose anything. He said they don't represent the Syrian people.
Quite on the contrary. By leaving, they may be taking away a major obstacle, and that will allow us to reach a solution.
The main opposition High Negotiations Committee halted its participation this week over growing violence in Syria that threatens a cessation of hostilities. Tuesday, airstrikes believed to be carried out by the government killed at least 44 people in opposition-held towns in northern Idlib province. A Western diplomat told Reuters that Geneva talks might not resume for at least a year if they're abandoned now. The UN Refugee Agency has confirmed reports that up to 500 people may have lost their lives when an overcrowded boat capsized and sank early this month in the Mediterranean between Libya and Italy. William Spindler is a UNHCR spokesman.
They were being transferred by the smugglers who were in command of their boat to a larger vessel that was already carrying hundreds of people. And while they were doing this in the middle of the sea at night, the bigger vessel went down.
The incident occurred April 8th. Monday, witnesses and survivors told VOA an unknown number swam to boats nearby and were taken to Greece. All were from African countries. A strong 6.1 magnitude aftershock rattled Ecuador's Pacific coast Wednesday, frightening residents barely able to recover from Saturday's powerful earthquake. This is VOA News. The United Nations Wednesday said delayed peace talks between the warring factions in Yemen will finally get underway Thursday in Kuwait after rebel Houthis agreed to join with assurances government forces would respect a ceasefire. Stefan Dujarric is a UN spokesman.
The delegations will focus on the implementation of Security Council Resolution 2216. They're expected to develop a framework that paves the way for a peaceful and orderly process based on the Gulf Cooperation Council initiative and the outcomes of the National Dialogue Conference.
The talks aim to forge a more inclusive government to end the violence that's left more than 6,000 dead and created a major humanitarian crisis. Officials in Myanmar are reviewing court cases against political prisoners, working to drop all remaining charges against them. A spokesperson for the president's office told VOA an estimated 200 political prisoners will be released after the New Year holiday, which ends April 20. Vikram Nehru is a Southeast Asia analyst at the Washington-based Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
It started on April the 9th when they, in fact, released 113, and then the president very recently announced the release of another 83, though apparently only 63 have been released so far. And now there's this additional effort to try and release the remaining political prisoners who have been put in prison for peaceful protests against the previous administration, for protesting against land grabs and that sort of thing. So it's very encouraging to see how fast the NLD administration is moving on this.
In her first statement since assuming the role of state counselor, Aung San Suu Kyi vowed to push for the release of political prisoners and student activists. In a rare meeting Wednesday, the NATO alliance and the Russia Council met in Brussels but failed to overcome disagreements over key issues, including differences over Russia's annexation of Crimea or recent ceasefire violations in eastern Ukraine. Ethiopia said Wednesday its army crossed the South Sudanese border in pursuit of suspects holding more than 100 children captive. The abductors believed to be Merlet tribesmen who attacked Ethiopian villages last week, killing more than 200 people. The Kenyan Wildlife Service Wednesday began stacking ivory in preparation for a special burning ceremony at month's end. Service Director General Katili Mbathi said more than 100 tons of ivory and rhino horns will be destroyed, making it the largest single destruction of ivory in history.
If we don't take the sort of action that we are taking now and the additional action that we are expecting to take, then there is a real threat of elephants being extinct in 50 years.
The ceremony coincides with a summit of the protection of elephants in Kenya later this month. At least two people have been killed in days of violence and looting in Zambia's capital, Lusaka, sparked by a series of ritual killings blamed on foreigners. The riots have targeted shops owned by Rwandans. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 21st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN Refugee Agency says as many as 400 African migrants might have been killed last week off the coast of Libya.
The survivors say migrants were being transferred from a small boat to a larger vessel when the vessel capsized. Only a fraction of the migrants were able to swim back to the smaller boat.
That's VOA correspondent Edward Urania in Cairo. South Sudan government outlined steps it has taken for rebel leader Riek Machar's safe return to Juba. More than a week after Comoros' presidential runoff election, the outcome remains in dispute. And Zambia's president issued special security orders to ensure calm after riots.
The president took this decision to try and protect the integrity of the country and, of course, protect the lives and property of the so-called foreign nationals.
Chishimba Kambwile is Zambia's information minister. The U.S. unveils an additional $20 million to help alleviate hunger in Zimbabwe. A new study says aspirin may cure cancer deaths. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Reports from survivors of a shipwreck off the coast of Libya indicate that around 400 migrants may have drowned, according to the United Nations Refugee Agency. As Edward Urania reports for VOA from Cairo, the UNHCR says 41 survivors of the tragedy were rescued and taken to the Greek island of Crete.
Greek authorities are preparing to move the few dozen survivors of the April 8 shipwreck from a stadium on the island of Crete to a facility on the Greek mainland. The survivors told the UN Refugee Agency that around 400 migrants drowned when their ship sank in the Mediterranean Sea off the coast of Libya. Witnesses who talked to VOA Somali and Horn of Africa services this week made similar claims. The survivors say migrants were being transferred from a small boat to a larger vessel when the vessel capsized. Only a fraction of the migrants were able to swim back to the smaller boat. A merchant ship eventually rescued 41 survivors and dropped them off near the Cretan port of Kalamata. UNHCR spokeswoman Ariadne Spanaki on Crete told journalists that many of the survivors were in shock and that some were crying. The Somali government said Monday that 200 of its nationals drowned in the tragedy. The vessels involved were reportedly also carrying migrants from Ethiopia, Sudan, Syria, and Egypt. Survivors say the smaller boat, which remained afloat, began its journey from Tobruk, Libya, near the Egyptian border. One young man from Ethiopia who survived the tragedy told journalists that very few of those who had set sail on the larger vessel survived the shipwreck. Said Sadek, a well-known Egyptian political sociologist, tells VOA that many African migrants and refugees are being tricked by smugglers into paying money to make the perilous journey to Europe.
Some European mafia and some African mafia collaborate to steal the money of those people and put them in hazardous voyages, and they don't care.
The UNHCR says that close to 1,000 people have drowned in refugee ships that have foundered off the coast of North Africa this year. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Zambian President Edgar Lungu has issued a special operational order to the security services to restore law and order in some parts of the capital, Lusaka. This, the government says, is to stop the recent spate of ritual murders, which resulted in riots in some townships. The administration also says the riots led to rumors that were responsible for xenophobic attacks on foreigners and their businesses. Information Minister Chishimba Kambwile tells reporter Peter Clotty that a special presidential order could be reversed by today, Thursday, after a review of the situation.
What transpired in the last 4 days in Zambia was unprecedented. where there was this rumor that, foreign shop owners were perpetrating ritual killings. And some criminals took advantage of that to start looting their shops and threatening their lives. And we tried to use the police, but the situation was not getting under control. And if we do not control this situation where Zambians can start beating up or looting shops belonging to investors, we may end up going back to a situation where the Kwacha loses its strength and then the economy would be on its knees. So the president took this decision to try and protect the integrity of the country and, of course, protect the lives and property of the so-called foreign nationals.
Now, Honorable Kambwili, I understand there have been some arrests following some of these incidents that you've described.
Yes, so far there have been two types of arrests. Police have arrested 249 people in connection with the rioting and looting. And they've also apprehended 11 suspects who are helping police with investigations leading to the ritual killings that have rocked Lusaka.
I also understand that a lot of politicians are raising concerns and accusing one another of inciting the youth to attack one against the other because of some political gains in the run-up of the elections. What can you tell me about the situation?
Yes, indeed. That is also a possibility, although we do not have tangible evidence to back up that allegation. But we have received this information that some opposition political parties have taken advantage to sponsor some youth to try and cause chaos so that the gains that the Kwacha has recorded against the major international currencies can be eroded.
I understand the operational order will be reviewed on Thursday. What is the situation?
It will be reviewed tomorrow around 9 o'clock. But I can confirm to you that the situation is that all the townships are now calm and the business has gone back to usual. And I'm convinced beyond reasonable doubt that the president will certainly reverse this order that he had given because the situation has calmed down.
Chishimba Kambwile is Zambia's information minister. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. More than a week after a presidential runoff election on the Comoro Islands, the outcome remains in doubt. Comoroan Vice President Mohamed Ali Sule has challenged the vote results, which gave victory to former coup leader Azali Assoumani. Third place presidential candidate and Grand Comore Governor Muini Baraka has also rejected the results. Vice President Sule has called for fresh elections on Anjouan, one of the three Comoro Islands, because he says results from 23 of the 400 polling stations there were likely to favor him. Mohamed Mchangama is president of the Consumer Society of Comoros. He says the situation remains tense in Comoros as Vice President Sule has asked the Constitutional Court to rule on the legality of the results from the island of Anjouan.
We have provisional results from the Electoral Commission saying that Colonel Azali, a former president, is the winner. But the difference between him and the second man, because there are three, is very small. It's a small of 1% or something. And, of course, the challenger, Dr. Mohamed Saleh, the actual vice president, is going to the Constitutional Court saying that there was fraud and many electors could not vote. So they are asking for a new vote in some parts of the island of Anjouan. So the situation here is quite tense, not that people are fighting, but everybody is claiming victory. Even yesterday, the followers of Mohamed Ali Saleh, the second guy, were having a meeting, which is supposed to be forbidden there, claiming that the Constitutional Court will find them, recognize them as winners.
So where do we go? Is the Constitutional Court going to consider this, or how is it going to be resolved?
Yeah, it will. I understand that they have started working today, you know, because contestants have 5 days, you know, to go to the Constitutional Court. So the Constitutional Court, they will start discussing, you know, the matters, you know, from today, and they have a few days, you know. So everybody now is waiting for the Constitutional Court. First one election taking place in one island, you know. I mean, this is called Tornan. There are 3 islands. And each island votes, you know, for 5 years. The president is elected for 5 years, and it has to be from, you know, one island, and it goes that way, you know. So this is the turn of Grand Comore again. And what happens is the island that has to elect, well, the president has to originate from, there is a first an election there where you can have as many candidates as possible. And then a sort of, you know, selection, a primary. And then the 3 winners, I mean, the 3 first ones, goes for a second round, you know. And this is, you know, it's what's, you know, what was taking place on the 10th of April.
The African Union observer said the first round was orderly and peaceful. Is that, was that the case?
Yeah, it was, it was the case. Yeah, it was peaceful, you know, a very minor thing, you know, but it was peaceful.
In the meantime, how is the business of government being conducted? I mean, what's going on?
Well, the actual president was elected for 5 years. His term is finishing on the 26th of May.
Mohamed Umchangama is president of the Consumer Society of the Comoros Islands. He spoke with me from the capital, Moroni. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today's Thursday, April 21st, and please send your comments and opinions to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. South Sudan's first vice president-designate Riek Machar's long-awaited return to Juba has been indefinitely postponed. Both the opposition and the government say they are working to resolve the stalemate. The government says it has granted permission for rebel chief of general staff General Simon Gatwich to fly over South Sudanese airspace with nearly 200 opposition fighters. But the rebels say the government must allow them to carry their own weapons. Mugumi Davis Rakrinch reports for VOA from Juba.
South Sudan Deputy Foreign Affairs Minister Bashir Bandi briefed reporters on the steps the government is taking to enable Machar's safe return to Juba in the coming days.
We are aware of the difficulties that this war has brought to us, and we'll want to overcome it sooner than later. So I'm happy to announce that we have accepted as a government that Riek should come with the 195 forces that are accompanying him and accompanying his chief of staff. We have given clearance also for all the planes that are coming, the 3 planes which are hired.
William Ezekiel, the SPLM-IO's spokesman, confirms the government has approved their request to Gatwich to be allowed to fly to Juba aboard the chartered plane.
Yes, we confirm the approval. We have received it from the government, granting permission for the flight of General Simon Garwidwell, who is chief of staff of SPLM in opposition, to use South Sudan airspaces. They have permitted the arrival of 195 soldiers with only RK-47, without organic weapons.
But Ezekiel insists the government must allow opposition fighters flying into Juba with their chief of staff to carry weapons of their choice ahead of the return of Machar.
This number of 195 soldiers, they should be accompanied by 20 PKM and 20 rocket-propelled grenades. So on our side, yes, we got the reply from the government side, but still we say that it is not satisfactory for us. We need the government to grant permission for our troops to arrive with all their organic weapons. We will not compromise on this. This is our legitimate right based on the composition of these 95 soldiers' military requirements.
Ban says the government will not yield to the opposition's demands.
We hope for the sake of peace they will accept it, because what is the guns for? Riek coming back home is coming to achieve peace. And after all, the protection of Riek is going to be responsibility of the government that they are forming. This is going to be so we'll be under one umbrella.
Both Bandi and Ezekiel agree the fighting has caused enough harm for ordinary South Sudanese, but remains unclear as to when Machar will be returned to the capital, which will enable the two sides to form the transitional government. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinj in Juba.
The United States Agency for International Development, also known as USAID, on Wednesday unveiled an additional $20 million in funding towards the World Food Program's humanitarian efforts to alleviate hunger in Zimbabwe. USAID Zimbabwe Mission Director Stephanie Fong said the United States is committed to working with the World Food Program to meet the immediate food needs of vulnerable Zimbabweans. United Nations Communications Specialist Sarah Gabriel Watt says the $20 million will go a long way to help food insecure areas as the situation there continues to deteriorate.
As you may recall, the United Nations has been working together with the government, and we've come up with a UN response plan to mitigate this effect of the drought and support around 2.8 million people who are being affected by this drought. We've been working together with all our partners, including USAID. So the UN has come up with $360 million humanitarian response plan. And this latest additional support from USAID is in response to this UN prepared humanitarian response plan.
We are seeing a high number of children, nearly 100,000 under the age of 5, estimated to be acutely malnourished. What are you doing about this?
The humanitarian response plan that has been put in place follows a sectoral approach, including the nutrition component. So we have a big chunk of the humanitarian response dedicated to address this worsening malnutrition case. So we are providing supplementary and therapeutic feeding in the most affected areas through UNICEF and other non-governmental organizations.
Lastly, have you been able to get enough funding for your projects, or you are still asking for more assistance?
We are asking for more assistance as we stand at the moment. The response plan covers the period of March 2016 to April 2017. And as I have indicated, we are calling for $360 million, out of which so far we've received from development and humanitarian partners, including USAID, around $36 million. So you can imagine the gap we are encountering. And we are working hard with all our partners to mobilize the remainder $224 million between now and April 2017.
United Nations Communications Specialist Sirak Gabriwat was speaking from Harare with Blessing Zulu of VOA's Zimbabwe program. A new study adds to a growing body of evidence that suggests that small doses of aspirin are good for your health. It doesn't work with apples, but turns out an aspirin a day can actually keep the doctor away, VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
It's been known for a while that a small daily dose of aspirin can lessen the risk of heart disease and even colon cancer. New findings suggest the painkiller may also increase survival in cancer patients by up to 20% if those patients are getting chemotherapy. Peter Elwood is a medical epidemiologist at Cardiff University School of Medicine in Great Britain. 40 years ago, he was involved in the first study exploring the beneficial effects of aspirin in the prevention of heart disease. Elwood's team reviewed 47 studies looking for evidence that aspirin benefited cancer patients. They found some.
And there's fairly consistent evidence of a 15 to 20% reduction in death and a reduction in metastatic spread by low-dose aspirin.
By low dose, he means 81 milligrams, the amount contained in a typical baby aspirin. The study, which was observational, followed cancer patients for 5 years. Elwood says the evidence is strongest that aspirin delays mortality among colorectal cancer patients, but there was benefit seen among people being treated for breast and prostate cancer. The beneficial ingredient appears to be salicylate, a small molecule that Elwood says many people are deficient in. In about 20% of patients, researchers have found a mutation known as PIK3CA that may interact with salicylate and could explain the reduction in colon cancer. Elwood called his study's findings, published in the journal PLOS ONE, exciting.
I feel very gratified because to people given the diagnosis of cancer, it's a glimmer of, it's not a cure, but it's a glimmer of hope and encouragement to them. So I'm thrilled to have this evidence from the study.
He recommends taking a little aspirin a day as a hedge against disease, but he's cautious.
If they asked me personally, what would I do if I had a diagnosis of cancer, I would say I would have no hesitation in taking it. But I do not recommend it to people. I want them to have the evidence and take their own decision.
The only major risk factor is that aspirin can cause gastrointestinal bleeding. But Elwood says it's usually not fatal, while the evidence points to big health benefits of taking a daily aspirin. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Egypt pipped Morocco 3-2 as Libya beat Angola 4-2 in Group B action at the Africa Futsal Cup of Nations here in Johannesburg, South Africa on Wednesday. Egypt topped the group with 7 points. Morocco has 6, Libya 4, and Angola have no point. Therefore, Egypt and Morocco join Mozambique and Zambia in the semifinals. Meanwhile, Kenya is disqualified from the Africa Under-20 Championships. The Confederation of African Football Secretary General Hicham El Amrani disclosed in Cairo, Egypt on Wednesday. According to El Amrani, Kenya fielded 5 overage players in their 1-1 draw against Sudan in Khartoum 2 weeks ago. Football Kenya Federation has 3 days to appeal this decision. Elsewhere, visiting Wydad Casablanca of Morocco held the Democratic Republic of Congo's Orange Africa Champions League title holders TP Mazembe to a 1-0 draw in Lubumbashi on Wednesday. Consequently, Wydad Casablanca eliminated TP Mazembe 3-1 on aggregate and progressed to the mini-league stage of the contest. Ivory Coast's ASEC Mimosa edged Libya's El Ahly Tripoli 3-2 on aggregate. Egypt's El Ahly pipped Tanzania's Young Africans 3-2 on aggregate as Zambia's Zesco United beat Stade Malien 5-2 on aggregate. Algeria's Entente Setif and Sudan's El Merrek drew 2-2 on aggregate. However, Entente Setif progressed on the away goal rule. Nigeria's Enyimba pipped Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel 4-3 in a post-match penalty shootout after they drew 3-3 on aggregate. Egypt's Zamalek dismissed Algeria's MO Bejaia 3-1 on aggregate, while the Democratic Republic of Congo's Vita Club and South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns drew 2-2 on aggregate. However, Vita Club progressed on the away goal rule. In cricket, Sierra Leone is promoted to the ICC Africa Division 1 Cricket League following their triumph at the 5-day Division 2 contest here in Johannesburg, South Africa. The 3-way contest over 2 legs also included Mozambique and Rwanda. The Division 1 features Botswana, Ghana, Kenya, Nigeria, Tanzania, and Uganda. Finally, the 4-day Zambia Open Golf Championship gets underway in the capital Lusaka today, Thursday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of African news. African-American abolitionist and humanitarian Harriet Tubman, who led hundreds of slaves to freedom, will replace Andrew Jackson on the U.S. $20 bill. U.S. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew confirmed on Wednesday Tubman will be the first African-American featured on U.S. currency and the first woman on paper currency in more than 100 years. He did not indicate when the new bill will be in circulation. And that's it for this Thursday, April 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as sports editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Dave Magnus, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good Thursday.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
Can't get enough of the sunny side of sports? Well, we've solved that problem. We now have a half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC GMT. So visit voanews.com for more details and enjoy the show.